If we reduce alcohol consumption, can we impact on atrial fibrillation?
Do hospital mergers improve patient care?
Does control of diabetes impact on a common infection?
And does gene therapy for hemophilia work?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on January 3rd, 2020.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine. And happy 2020 to our listeners.
Yes, indeed. Happy New Year to all. Speaking of the New Year then, that brings us very nicely to the New England Journal of Medicine and what I served up about, if we control alcohol consumption, can we impact on atrial fibrillation? This was an interesting study to me, and you probably knew a whole lot more about this than I did because you're a cardiologist and I'm not. This was a look at people who consumed alcohol and whether or not they also had atrial fibrillation, if they reduced their alcohol consumption and essentially went to abstinence or very, very low consumption, would it impact on their atrial fibrillation? I think one of the things that was so fascinating to me about this study was that they attempted to recruit people who fell into this situation, that is, had atrial fibrillation and also drank alcohol regularly. In 700 people almost met the criteria, and it took them a very long time to get 140 patients who were going to participate, who were willing to actually consent to this study. So those 140, 70 were assigned to an abstinence group and 70 to the control group. That was just keep on drinking what you normally drink. In the abstinence group, they did say to them, hey, we can do some urinalysis to make sure you really aren't drinking a bunch of alcohol. And they tried to initially get this study to go on for a year, but again, their oversight group had to reduce the period of time to 6 months because people weren't willing to abstain from alcohol for a year. So I thought all that was really pretty interesting background. And basically what they showed that was when people abstained from alcohol, it reduced their arrhythmia recurrences. It also reduced secondary endpoints like hospitalization for atrial fibrillation. And so there's some biological plausibility that also supports this, and it's a very, very interesting social commentary.
This is important because over 33 million people worldwide are affected by atrial fibrillation, and it's one of the leading causes of stroke. Now, when you combine that with almost 60% of Americans drink regularly, and you know, by the way, that alcohol intake is directly related to the incidence or recurrence of atrial fibrillation, this ends up being an important study. They selected individuals who were already drinking 10 or more drinks per week, had a history of atrial fibrillation, but were in sinus rhythm, a normal rhythm, when they entered the trial. Just abstinence for no more than 2 weeks decreased the recurrence of atrial fibrillation. It occurred later, and it also decreased the total amount of time people spent in atrial fibrillation. People were drinking an average of 17 drinks per week, and those that were abstinent decreased it to 2 drinks per week. This shows that abstinence from alcohol reduces atrial fibrillation recurrence.
It also shows, however, that the resistance to this strategy, to this intervention, is huge.
The other interesting thing is that those individuals that were abstinent, it decreased their weight by about 9 or 10 pounds because they weren't on a diet. It just shows how many empty calories one consumes, especially if they're drinking 17 drinks per week. Now, Elizabeth, we've reported before that drinking 1 or 2 drinks per day on average for men and 1 per day on average for women decreases cardiovascular death and cardiovascular morbidity as well. So we have to balance between trying to keep our alcohol intake as low as possible to prevent atrial fibrillation, but modest so that it can help prevent cardiovascular death and morbidity as well.
Yeah, and a tough sell. So on that Happy New Year note, keep your alcohol consumption kind of low. Let's stay in the New England Journal of Medicine and let's look at this. Gosh, gene therapy is something that's had all this promise. And in this case, it looks like some of that promise came to fruition, at least in hemophilia.
For listeners that may not be aware, hemophilia is a bleeding disorder where people are prone to have excessive bleeding, particularly in the large joints, because they aren't making enough of a clotting factor. Several years ago, gene therapy was introduced to a small number of individuals with hemophilia, wondering, first of all, whether it was safe. The first 3 individuals got a small amount of genes that were incorporated into a virus, had it infused, and the virus allowed the gene to fuse with the own individual's genetic material so they could begin to manufacture factor VIII. In the first three individuals, shown to be safe. And then the next two cohorts, they enrolled six additional individuals in each cohort at a higher gene dose. So these are the results after 4 years. And what I'm happy to report is the gene therapy was successful. And why this is important is this is a really large gene, and it had to be infected into cells in two different slices, and then those slices had to be joined, but was successful. Over the course of 3 to 4 years, it decreased the bleeding episodes by 96%. That the vast majority of individuals still had factor VIII detectable. It reduced the use of exogenous factor VIII, and it decreased transfusions and complications related to hemophilia.
This model of utilizing viruses to transfect is also operational in current therapies for sickle cell disease. And I'm wondering what you think are the barriers. The barrier to me is the price.
There are a number of barriers. There are always possible side effects. For example, in these individuals, all of them develop an increase in their liver enzymes immediately after infection. Is there good evidence that there is long-term benefit from it? Cost will always come down. Any new therapy, the cost is always high, but it comes down. You have to look at it, not only the cost of the therapy, but these individuals were using exogenous factor VIII. They had bleeding complications. They had hospitalizations and joint replacements as a result of the hemophilia. We could potentially abrogate all of those things by using gene therapy.
Well, we're going to look forward to expansion of that. Let's turn from here to JAMA Network Open. This was another one that I picked because this was a relationship that, again, I had been heretofore unaware of. This is the relationship between Group B streptococcal infections, which can invade a number of body sites, and diabetes, which, again, I was not really tuned into that particular relationship. This is a VA population, and between 2008 and 2017, about 5,200 patients experienced about 5,500 invasive Group B streptococcal infections. Which ones were those? Most of them, osteomyelitis, bacteremia without focus, skin or soft tissue infections, and pneumonia or empyema. They looked at all-cause mortality and, no surprise, found that that was highest among patients with peritonitis and pneumonia or empyema. And the thing that I thought was really interesting was that those people who had diabetes and poor long-term glycemic control had a fourfold higher risk of having one of these infections than those who did have diabetes but had good glycemic control. And so it's one of those things that argues to me again and again that, gosh, keeping your diabetes under control is just such an important factor.
Invasive Group B strep over the last 20 to 25 years has tripled in the United States. We're talking about invasive infections. This VA cohort shows some of the risk factors. We know that obesity is a risk factor for it, older age is a risk factor for it, diabetes is a risk factor for it, and now we know that poor glycemic control in that setting is also an important risk factor. And by the way, the mortality with this infection is low if it's a superficial skin infection or even a bone infection, but the mortality is pretty high if it's a lung infection or if it's peritonitis. See, mortality associated with this infection can be as high as 20 or 25%. And we need to take advantage of this information.
Absolutely, because I suspect this is not true just in the VA population. I'm sure it's true among all people who have diabetes.
To my knowledge, this is the first study in a large population that's shown poor glycemic control is also a risk factor. And again, it's modifiable. We ought to take that to heart.
Let's turn to your final one. This is also an interesting one for 2020. What happens after hospitals merge with regard to the quality of care?
Over the last two decades, the hospital industry really has consolidated substantially in the United States. Previous studies have shown that these mergers and acquisitions usually lead to higher negotiated prices with private insurers, but really we know less about the quality of care. So what these investigators did was they looked at four measures of quality care: clinical process measures, how do people treat pneumonia and heart disease and post-surgical care. They looked at the mortality and the rate of readmission and also the patient experience. And they did that for about 250 hospitals that had been merged or acquired, and they had about 2,000 control hospitals. And they looked at both of these sets of hospitals about 2 to 3 years before the mergers and for 3 to 4 years afterwards. And what they discovered is that those that merged or were acquired, there was actually a modest decline in performance of the patient experience. Mergers or acquisitions did not improve 30-day readmissions rate, hospital mortality, and it looked like there may be a little bit better improvement in clinical process measures, but actually when they drilled down, those clinical processes actually improved before the hospitals were acquired, not afterwards.
And that seems like a missed opportunity to me. I mean, when there are acquisitions and mergers, that seems like a time to really assess all of that and hopefully improve it.
Well, you'd like to think that you bring the best of either hospital system to the table, but sometimes what you do is you bring the worst to the table. Sometimes you increase the bureaucracy, you divert attention from what's important, that is the quality of care, to the integration itself. All the studies to date that look at hospital acquisitions and mergers don't show that it reduces costs, and it really doesn't show that it improves quality. And that's very disappointing.
And it's also interesting because so many health systems are using this model as a way to remain profitable. And so there's a pretty serious driver that's behind that. And the other thing that we've noted among a lot of hospitals are hospital closures. And so I'm wondering how this factor is going to play out ultimately, even over the next year.
And many of those hospital closures occur in rural areas where the hospitals are small and the payment doesn't meet the expenses of the hospital. Now, unfortunately, this particular study doesn't address it. But I think what the study does say is if people provide the argument this merger acquisition will improve quality of care, you know, that's a great hypothesis, but the studies to date haven't proven that to be the case.
More work to do, as always. On that note, I wish you a happy new year. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up in 2020 and make healthy choices.